Protesters gather in front of Congressman Rutherford's office after he refuses to hold a town hall meeting. Massive layoffs and new management at Jacksonville-based CSX Transportation. And a bill moving through City Council will try to help ex-offenders finding employment. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. We're also streaming the audio of the show right now on our Facebook page. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday Roundtable. Get on the line now and join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with acclaimed filmmaker Myra Nair as she visits Jacksonville, part of the library's Jax Reads Initiative. Plus, a look at a novel fundraising idea, Women with Heart. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and time for the weekly roundtable as we welcome Tessa Duval, reporter for the Florida Times-Union. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. A.G. Gankarski from Florida Politics is here.
Thank you for having me.
WJCT's business analyst, John Burr.
Good morning.
And our own WJCT reporter, Lindsay Kilbride.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being here, everyone, and lots to discuss this Friday. From hundreds getting pink slips at CSX to local police signing off on Mayor Curry's pension deal and more. But our top story, angry town halls across the country for GOP congressmen right now, and Jacksonville is no exception. This week, Congressman John Rutherford was in town for the congressional recess, but he decided not to hold a town hall meeting for his constituents. So dozens of them showed up outside his district office in South Point and held one without him. They called it resistance recess, and they even had an empty chair available for the congressman. This from our news partner, WJXT. Democrat Diane Larson says she's worried Rutherford will be too partisan in Congress.
I knew him as a sheriff.
Yeah.
And so I respected him as a sheriff. My concern is that he's new, and my other concern is that he's Republican, and that my concern is that he will just vote party line and not listen to us.
Rutherford, though, says he does plan on holding several town hall meetings. He was at a couple of events this week, including a change of command ceremony at NAS Jax when this protest was happening. He says his schedule didn't allow time for a town hall meeting. Here's the congressman.
Look, I look for every way possible to interact with my constituents. I mean, you know me as sheriff. How many, you know, heck, I did 106 town halls when we did Taser, if you remember that. So absolutely I'll be doing town halls. I love going out and meeting the public face-to-face, but, you know, this trip, it just didn't work in.
All right. So as the constituents pressing the congressman say they want answers on the funding of public schools, welcoming refugees into America, and keeping the Affordable Care Act, we want to know your thoughts about this. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa and Jax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. Tessa Duval, let's begin with you. We've seen this spectacle all across the country of congressmen either dodging town halls during the recess or being yelled at by their constituents. It's almost like a replay of the 2009 town halls that formed the basis of the Tea Party during President Obama's first term when his administration was trying to enact the Affordable Care Act. Now we're seeing almost a mirror image of that.
You know, I just have to share this headline that I came across right before we came in here for the show. From the Washington Post, Louis Gohmert from Texas said that, you know, the threat of violence at town halls was part of the reason that had put him off. And he even cited the incident about Gabby Giffords, where she was shot when she was meeting with constituents. And her response was, have some courage. And I think that that is probably a message that a lot of representatives need to hear right now, that these are your constituents, whether or not they have the same letter after their name as you, you still represent mm-hmm. them. You have an obligation to hear them.
And Rutherford was spared some of the spectacle other members of Congress have received in recent days. A.G. Gankarski, like the House Oversight Chairman Jason Chaffetz out in Utah, people chanting at him, do your job. Congress reps like Chavis are saying, a lot of these protesters are paid. They're coming from outside the district. They dispute that. But we did see at least a semblance of that in Jacksonville this week.
Well, I was at the Thursday protest at Rutherford's district headquarters. These were local people. These were not paid protesters. They were organizers with the Indivisible Group, the Women's March, things like that. And, you know, they had a laundry list of critiques, you know, immigration, Russia ties from the Trump administration and so on. A lot of questions that I don't think John Rutherford really wanted to answer. Rutherford did make public appearances. I covered a thing he did Tuesday with the Young Catholics group. He talked for about 30, 35 minutes about faith and issues like that. He got one political question about the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. He said that he'd vote to repeal, but also to replace. But, you know, John Rutherford's not going to be a leader on this issue. He's a freshman in Congress. He's pushing 70. He's interested in local issues and, you know, military appropriations. So, I mean, Rutherford's going to be party line vote. So, you know, on that particular issue, you know, he's pretty much going to do what he's expected to do.
Yeah, it's 549-2937 to join us. Lindsey Kilbride, also Congressman Rutherford had some health problems right after he got up to Washington, although he seems to be doing better now. And let's not leave out the other congressman from this area, Al Lawson, the Democratic congressman, who isn't going to be facing quite the same fire on these issues, but he's also part of the conversation.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's just, you know, we have a very polarizing president right now. You could also say that about Obama. And people, you know, want to know what their representatives are thinking about a lot of these new things that are being proposed and new things with the Trump administration. I mean, as AG was saying, with immigration and the Affordable Care Act and things like that, some of them haven't heard from their local representatives what they're planning to do and how they plan to vote on some of these things.
And John Burr, it was striking to see the former Speaker of the House, John Boehner. He actually burst into laughter this week when he was asked if he thought Congress would repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. He said, no way. It's not going to happen. He doesn't think it's politically possible.
I think John Boehner's bursting into laughter a lot these days. you know,
it's easy to laugh when you're no longer in that situation,
well,
I guess.
I mean, he knows. Yeah. He knows what's going on. But, you know, with as far as Rutherford goes, I think it's pretty weak of him to say, you know, we just couldn't fit it in. I mean, come on. It's a recess. These recesses are traditionally used to meet with constituents and reconnect with your local political base. I mean, that's really what they're kind of all about and have been for years. And, you know, if he can't fit it in, then he should really be finding time to fit it in.
And Rutherford's not alone. Tessa Duvall of the Times Union, members of Congress all over the country have been really ducking their constituents when they've seen the news coverage of these rowdy, angry town halls where constituents are hopping mad about this range of issues.
I think if people are angry, they're probably worth listening to. You know, there might be a reason behind that. Now, whether you have to agree with it, you don't have to, but you should at least hear your constituents out.
All right. Let's go to your calls on the top stories of the week at 549-2937. Lisa is in St. Augustine. Hi, Lisa. Good morning. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. And I hope I didn't miss it just in calling in. But I also would like you to bring up that DeSantis has also been missing in action in terms of town halls. And he seems to like have found this sort of blind spot where nobody really kind of comments on him. But we really need to be paying attention to the votes that he makes. And I went to the Women's March and I receive all the emails from those groups and as well as affiliated groups. And I can tell you this is homegrown and it's real people that are protesting because we are very upset with what's going on in Washington and we feel very good and that the people that we sent up there are not speaking for all of us. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. And so much of that, AG, is due to gerrymandered districts. That's part of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you mentioned a minute ago, the group Indivisible, they've taken a page out of the Tea Party's playbook in terms of organizing opposition to the president's agenda in the same way small grassroots Tea Party groups around the country organized in opposition to Barack Obama's agenda.
Yeah, I mean, it's a parallel process. And the advantage that people have in 2017 that the Tea Party didn't have initially was, you know, proliferation of social media. You know, older people are on social media, which wasn't initially the case 8 years ago. And there's a lot of pent-up angst. I mean, Hillary Clinton got more votes than Donald Trump did in the election. But because of gerrymandered districts, because of the way that, you know, apportionment's set up, you know, we have a Republican majority in both houses, a Republican presidency, and, you know, very much a hard right slash nationalist kind of orientation in D.C. And, you know, I wanted to address the caller's point about DeSantis, because it does come back to gerrymandering and redistricting. DeSantis once represented Ponte Vedra. His district's been moved south in St. Johns County. And, you know, he kind of falls in a gap between media markets. You know, Flagler doesn't have a station. Daytona does have a station, but Daytona shares with Orlando. So, you know, he and Ted Yoho both don't get the coverage they might otherwise get unless they're on national outlets.
See Ted Yoho interviewed increasingly on national outlets.
Yeah, and Ron wants that too. But, you know, here's the thing with Rutherford, and this is, you know, sort of the counter argument why he might not want to hear from, you know, Democratic activists. I mean, that race was decided in August of last year in the Republican primary. And that's where all the money was spent. You know, you had people spending, you know, $1 million on one candidate that lost. You had Rutherford spending $600,000 or so, and so on. So, I mean, this is really the thing. When we talk about a politician's base, the base is the donor class. Because when you have a district 70% Republican, all you have to do is party line. You're going to win, you know, by 20, 30 points.
Lindsay Kilbride.
If these representatives and public officials are dodging town halls because they don't want to face the wrath of these angry people who are mostly, you know, in the opposition party. I mean, they didn't sign up to represent just the Republicans in their district. You know, they signed up to represent everyone. That's what comes along with being a representative, is hearing from people who don't agree with you. I think in their minds, if they're thinking this is just going to be me completely slaughtered by these people, I mean, you have to take it.
Florence on the east side. Hey, Florence, thanks for calling the show. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, you guys. This is Florence from Character Council. I'll say I'm from Character Council today. Back to Rutherford. AJ, I love how you talked about, like, is he going to be the party line? And really, as I've been thinking about, I'm a Democrat, and I'm actually calling to say, hey, Rutherford has made some really big changes, like in his tenure as a sheriff. He's gone against a lot of policies. He created amazing programs. And one of the things that I believe that we have an opportunity to talk to, one of his platforms that he ran on, was the mental health issues. And really, that's the zone of, he came in and he stood on that platform of mental health wellness as the way to cut crime. That's where I really believe if we can continue to press him on that component of the healthcare system, we could do some winning. That's a place in our town that, as we're all trying to solve the homeless problem and all the other problems we're all working to solve, the mental health component of everything that's going on right now, that I believe if we can keep standing on that platform, we can make some changes. So thank you all for all of your insights, and let's just keep rocking it.
Yeah, thank you, Florence. Thanks for that call.
I'll address that briefly. You know, Rutherford was actually more heterodox as a thinker before the GOP primary last year than he was after he got the nomination. He had people running to his right in that primary. He got a lot of heat for coming out against the death penalty. Mm-hmm. That's not a position most Republicans take. But once he got the nomination, you know, he fell in line behind the national priorities. I mean, you know, realistically, the local road to appropriations on the federal level is, you know, military. We want more at Mayport. We want, you know, more money for Tiger grants and other things like that. So, you know, it behooves Rutherford to play ball with the Trump administration as priorities. And, you know, I think that's going to be the short-term approach for Rutherford.
That call just showed that as sheriff, John Rutherford did build up a lot of bipartisan goodwill, though.
Yeah.
And this experience of having constituents mad and angry, you know, that's a change for him. He was used to a sheriff having really high popularity, mm-hmm. widespread goodwill.
He did take it, though. He got a lot of pressure during his sheriff's tenure for a number of things, especially when the budget cuts started happening after 2008 crash.
All right, let's go to Jose on the south side. Jose, good morning.
Yeah, talking about Rutherford, about party lines, isn't that what the both political parties do? I don't think nothing new. That's what they all do, you know, because they have to get money and they have to get support from their old politicians in D.C. But my main point is those protesters at the meeting, I think they are, nobody's listening to them, because nationwide, you see the violence, you see burning cars, you see attacking people that they don't believe it in. I think it was a disservice, to be honest, and nobody cares, honestly. If they were more to the point, you see those videos on TV, they just shouting, like a shouting match between among themselves. Why don't they go and ask a question and let the guy talk? But you got 3, 4, 5 guys jumping at the same time. To me, their reputation is already in the toilet. And by doing that, it's going to even make it worse, honestly.
And that's Jose. Jose, thanks for the call. That's Jose on the south side. Tessa?
Well, I haven't seen any burning cars in Jacksonville yet, so I'm not sure that that's Rutherford's excuse. Sorry, I'm tongue-tied this morning, guys.
But what about his comment? Well, I don't take these protesters seriously because of the way some of them are behaving.
Well, I think, you know, what we haven't touched on this morning is that, you know, we've implied, but a lot of people are politically engaged in a way that they haven't been yet. You know, one of my colleagues just had a story this weekend about, you know, the resistance to Trump in the Jacksonville area. And a lot of the folks said, you know, I'm retired. I haven't had time to do this before. And it's kind of fun to be out here protesting. They also said if they were getting paid, they didn't know about that. They wanted to make that known. But you know, I think what is the next step in activism? I mean, people are getting engaged in ways they never had before. I mean, who's to say that we don't see candidates come out of this, or, you know, directing money toward candidates who support the causes? I mean, I think that's something every representative and elected official should be thinking about.
John Burr.
Well, that I think she's exactly right. I mean, this is a long game. This isn't, you know, what are we going to score on the next news cycle? This is, you know, how are we going to do in the midterms in 2 years, and how are we going to get the presidency back? So it's a long-term game, and, you know, they're going to keep fighting. And you know, I think it's very healthy to see a lot more political engagement than we've seen, especially in Jacksonville, which frankly has been a politically pretty sleepy place.
Hey, we're getting a lot of calls on this topic, so yeah, definitely our listeners are engaged. Gary is in Arlington. Hi, Gary. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. As a matter of fact, the very first thing you started talking about was what I was going to call you. Why didn't John Rutherford hold a town hall meeting? And lo and behold, it's a big issue with you, too. Thank you. But the thing that I wanted to talk about was that I went on the Internet and contacted contacted his office, and left about 5 messages for him. He's never answered any of them. And I called his office in Washington, and I said, what's up? And the answer I was given was that, we're just getting off the ground here, but it sounds like, you know, you're not taking that as an excuse. And I kind of scratched my head and said, that's not much of an excuse. And the second thing is, it says, if you want to subscribe to his email newsletter, you know, click here. I did. I called. I said, why haven't I gotten an email newsletter? And again, the woman said, we're just getting off the ground. Well, my question was, well, if you're just getting off the ground, why, then don't offer an email newsletter to us if you aren't going to do it. So that was kind of one thing. Now, the other thing, I watched the Rachel Maddow show last night and nearly fell out of my chair when she was talking about that 6 people were walked out of the White House. You probably heard about that, because they failed the FBI security check. Susie Wiles' daughter was more or less walked out of the White House yesterday, too, for having failed this. I've nearly fell out of my chair. Susie Wiles' daughter, hey, that's here in Jacksonville. Were you aware of that?
Gary, thanks for the call about that. Let's talk about that for just a minute. Susie Wiles, of course, ran the successful Florida campaign for Donald Trump. Her daughter was given a position in the White House after Trump's election. She's a seasoned political operative in this community. A.G., Tessa?
Yeah. Susie has actually gone up to D.C. part-time to work for Ballard Partners, doing a lot of lobbying with the Trump administration. She's got goodwill there. Ballard Partners does. Brian Ballard was part of his finance committee for his inauguration, et cetera. Caroline had a job as
that's her daughter.
Yeah, as a secretary, you know, basically appointment secretary for Trump in the White House. There was an FBI clearance. She failed it along with some other people. Nobody really knows why it was failed. I mean, Politico speculated that it could be anything from, you know, financial issues to you name it, the sort of things that, you know, hurt on background checks. She'll land in Treasury or something like that. So, you know, Caroline Wiles is going to be fine. But, you know, these sort of things happen, you know, in administration's transition because, you know, we live our daily lives. Some of us can't pass federal, you know, checks like that. And, you know, you don't find out until the hiring process. So, you know, it's a sort of a black eye, but it's not as big a deal as it sounds.
Tessa.
I actually agree with everything AG just said.
All right. And lots of people waiting on hold, but we need to move on and discuss a few other news and notes from the week. It's 549-2937 to join us as we talk about the week's top stories with our Friday roundtable and also making headlines this week, bad news at CSX Transportation. There's been a lot of talk about a hostile takeover of CSX recently, and at the same time this week, top management announced that they're going to retire, and 1,000 management employees, most of whom based here in Jacksonville, are getting laid off. This after years of good job announcements coming into Jacksonville, like Amazon, Ernst & Young, IKEA, and more bringing jobs to town. What do you think about the big CSX layoffs? 549-2937. John Burr, our business analyst, not good news for CSX or the city, but more broadly, the long take to watch is whether this takeover battle at CSX might mean CSX corporate headquarters leaving Jacksonville, correct?
That would be the worst case scenario, yes, because, you know, when you have a corporate headquarters of a S&P 500 company like CSX, it brings all kinds of good things to a city. And we've lost a bunch. We've lost a bunch of headquarters in the last 20 years here, banks and insurance companies and other things. So I think that is what people really fear the most, even more than 1,000 managerial, well-paid managerial jobs being lost.
Yeah, you know, you're seeing the sort of evolution at CSX right now. They've been kind of behind the curve in terms of technology, in terms of routing and things like that. You know, when you're sitting at a railroad stop for 45 minutes, part of that's because they're having issues with routing. And, you know, CSX is kind of a two-tier thing. They have full-time employees and they have contractors doing a lot of the work on the inside. You know, the management class is something that they can pair. You've got a lot of older, white-collar, white people who can be kind of paired out. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a lot of legacy costs, a lot of pension costs, and so on. You know, Harrison, the guy who potentially could take over, is a turnaround expert. He's done it twice before. And the way a turnaround expert works is you find ways to cut the fat and you keep central operations going. I mean, I think CSX is going to be a sleeker, more technological company. But, you know, the question that, you know, is being raised right now is, you know, how sustainable was the previous model? Now, for the city, there's a different issue. Mm-hmm. You're losing 1,000 jobs. I don't know how active Lenny Curry's administration is in it. He said that he's disappointed this is happening, but this is why we bring jobs to the city. But, you know, with the issues about incentives in Tallahassee, you know, for job creation, you know, it might be harder to replace those 1,000 jobs, especially at that salary level, than it might have been, you know, a couple years ago.
Well, so here's another point. I mean, you know, people are saying this is a hostile takeover. It's not hostile, really. The board of directors of CSX has obviously paved the way for Hunter Harrison to come in. That's what these layoffs are all about. This is like the first step. This is the first thing that Hunter Harrison would want to do. He probably made it a condition of his coming in as the CEO. So it's a takeover, but it's not hostile. And you know, CSX didn't have a succession plan for Michael Ward, who's
now retiring early.
Yeah, he's been the CEO there for 15 years, generally regarded as done a really good job. But they had no succession plan, and he's put his hand up in the last couple of years saying, "Hey guys, it's time to take me out of the game." You know, I don't think this is hostile. I think it's actually It's an almost an invited situation.
I'm sure it feels hostile to the people losing their jobs, though, 1,000 of them.
But yeah. When you use the word hostile takeover, that implies that it's a corporate raider coming in and taking over the corporation. I don't think that's quite
I hear you saying is the board doesn't see it that way, although that's certainly the way it's been playing in the national business press, that Harrison has a reputation for turning around railroad companies, but doing so in a way that hollows out those companies.
That's right, and and I think by inference you can surmise that that's what the board wants. The board wants a more profitable company. The board wants the stock to go up. The board is looking at the stockholders' interests here. It all fits together, and I think Hunter Harrison is probably very much wanted by the board.
Lindsay Kilbride.
Yeah, I was kind of going to mimic that. I mean, when you Google Harrison, I mean, that's what you find. This is what he does. So to expect anything else, I don't know. You know, you haven't read up on his techniques and how he turns these railroad companies around. But I think also parroting what's already been said, which I think is a good point, which is, you know, we're bringing so many jobs into Jacksonville, but how many of them are actually going to be able to pay what these people are being paid and give them a similar role? I don't know.
Right. And it's the number to join us, 549-2937, as we talk about the top stories of the week. Also this week, a bill moved through City Council designed to make it easier for ex-offenders leaving prison to find jobs with city contractors. Councilman Garrett Dennis introduced this, and it would require contracts of at least $200,000 to reach out to one of four local organizations that helps ex-offenders trying to get a position. Dennis says many ex-offenders just need a break, getting back into the workforce.
We have a crime problem here in Jacksonville. We need to put everything on the table. We need to use every tool in the toolbox to fight crime. And this is just one tool in the toolbox.
Dennis, though, pulled back on some of the bill's requirements after getting complaints from city contractors. A.G. Gankarski, they said that this measure would put too much of a burden on their businesses, and many of them actually already hire ex-offenders.
Yeah. You know, the bill basically was intended to reaffirm a 2008 ordinance requiring coordination between contractors and the city's training organizations like Operation New Hope and so forth to get ex-offenders in play. The builders and contractors balked during the committee process. It went to three committees. It stalled out in the third committee, actually. It's got to go back for some public notice hearings and some workshopping. But basically, they were saying that this already happens. Council people are saying, well, this imposes new burdens on businesses. And Garrett Dennis, you know, he had an ambitious bill that he didn't quite think all the way through. If he had formulated this with the builders and contractors on the front end, it would have been a cleaner committee process. But, you know, as it is, it's in limbo, and it might hang in limbo for a long time.
Let's go to go ahead, John.
Yeah, it's really it's a well-intentioned bill, and it's probably a good idea, but I think AG's right. If you're going to try to pass something like this, you got to work with the contractors before you bring out the product, or otherwise, you know, they're not going to like it, and that's going to be the end of it.
And what do you think, listeners, about the big pension deal that just got struck with the Jacksonville Police Union? It's 549-2937 to join in on that. The union overwhelmingly approving a contract proposal Thursday from the mayor, and it would place future hires into 401k style accounts instead of pensions, a huge change for the JSO and likely Jacksonville, I think, the largest city now that's going to make this type of change for its police force. Yeah. We're still waiting on the fire department to sign off, though.
Yeah, the fire department votes, you know, next month, the 13th through the 15th. So we'll find out March 15th how they are. But, you know, the police union went for it big time. 65% of officers, 80% of management staff. And, you know, it's a good deal for current employees. They get raises, 20% over 3 years, and a 3% salary bump pretty much immediately. They get their benefits restored to the way they were before the 2015 pension agreement, pretty much rips that deal up. You know, and the new hires get a defined contribution plan, 25% city match. The big question that everybody has that the mayor's office is not answering and needs to answer, hello Lenny Curry, is what is this going to cost the city? What are the actual breakdowns look like? You know, the actuarial studies that were released saying that, you know, if we have a 10% contribution, a 12% contribution, so cost and save this much money. Because the pension tax last year was sold on the idea that it was going to save money when we went to DC plans. But if the city is doubling its match for new hires, you know, questions are really raised. How much money is going to be saved? Is this going to cost the city more? You know, this is sort of a conversation that Mayor Curry needs to have with the city immediately.
And it's not really good for him to say, just to hide behind the state law about bargaining, and I don't want to talk about it until blah, blah, blah. You know, what he's going to do is the city council is going to take it up. Then he's going to release the financial information and in a relatively short amount of time to analyze something extremely complicated. And that's not the way you really do business. He should be releasing that financial information now. Can the city afford this? How will the city afford this? How does it compare to what we have now? These are real questions, and they need time to be analyzed.
Tessa.
You know, I always think it's a great thing when we can understand the full impact. You know, at the Times Union, we've been on this pension for a long time. You know, understanding its impact, its cost to the city, I mean, that's huge. That is absolutely, I mean, it's crucial. This is, you know, the city's most pressing financial issue, and we've got to understand it fully.
Yeah, and Lindsay, you're one of many reporters that has been trying to educate the public about this long process, but we'll continue to follow it here in our newsroom as well.
Yep.
All right. Okay, enough said about that. All right, finally, it's our look at these strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida does a man blame his dog for the shooting of his girlfriend.
I know this guy.
This week in Jacksonville, the Times Union reports a 25-year-old Westside man told police his sleeping girlfriend was shot in the right leg. At their home, he took Diesel the dog outside late Tuesday and told police when they came back in, Diesel entered the bedroom, jumped up on the nightstand, and the gun that was sitting on top went off.
Bow, wow, wow, yippee-o, yippee-a.
The boyfriend said he wrapped towels around his girlfriend's leg and called 911. No word if Diesel has opposable digits.
West side, anything's possible.
That's right. Only in Florida can you learn yoga poses that allow you to hold on to your beer. This happened last weekend at the Uzu Bar in Gainesville, the sold-out event sponsored by Shock Top. Participants learned how to either drink from the bottle while doing yoga or balancing the bottle on their head. The event blew up on Facebook with over 500 people vying for just 30 spots available on the rooftop bar. Sponsors say future classes are already being planned. Why aren't they bringing this to Jacksonville is my only question.
The people need to know.
The downward sogs position.
Thank you to our panel. As always, it's so good to see you. A.G. Gankarski, Tessa Duvall, John Burr, and Lindsay Kilbride. Have a great weekend, you guys.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, another big week of headlines on the Friday News Roundup. Big and noisy. Town halls and Tea Party tactics, new rules worry millions of undocumented immigrants, and NASA brings exciting news from 40 light years away. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT.
Ask any Spaniard about their local specialties and it always comes back to the ham.
Saudi Arabia might have oil. South Africa might have diamonds. But Spain's got jamón.
Get acquainted with the Fat Tuesday traditions of Germany's Rhineland and Venice.
Carnival is a very big party.
And hear how Americans star on Norwegian TV on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
folk, blues, jazz, R&B, country, western, Americana. It's all acoustic and it's all in one place. And that one place is String Theory. And you can hear String Theory Friday nights at 11 p.m. only on 89.9 WJCT. String Theory, the very best of modern acoustic music. This and every Friday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, award-winning filmmaker Mira Nair is coming to the Jacksonville Library in a few weeks for a special presentation, part of the city's Jax Reads initiative. Nair's acclaimed direction of the film The Namesake, based on the beloved book, is just one of her amazing movies, films like Monsoon Wedding and Salaam Bombay and many others. Right now, the library wants everyone in town to pick up The Namesake and read it. It's part of the citywide Jax Reads initiative, and see the movie, too. We're so pleased to have filmmaker Mira Nair on the line now with a preview of her talk at the public library. Mira Nair, a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And my name is Mira Nair.
Oh, that's Nair. Oh, I'm so sorry. I apologize for that.
And it's Mira. No problem. I like my name pronounced correctly.
Of course. And so it's such a pleasure to have you coming to Jacksonville and talk about your direction of the story of The Namesake. It was based on a book, of course. How did you get involved with the film, The Namesake?
I have loved Chumpa Lahiri's writing from her first book, the short stories of Interpreter of Maladies. And I bought The Namesake as I would a fan, of the next book was The Namesake, and did not read it for about 6 months somehow. I was making Vanity Fair, the movie with Reese Witherspoon at the time. And suddenly, a few months into finishing Vanity Fair, I lost very unexpectedly a parent. My mother-in-law, who I regard really like a mother, in the New York hospital of malpractice. And I was completely, it was my first experience of abject loss, and of burying a person who is, not in her home in a foreign country. She came from East Africa, and we were in the Siberian snowstorm in New Jersey where we buried her. And in that moment of incredible melancholy and confusion, I happened to pick up this novel, The Namesake, on my way back on a plane to India. And I just read this, which is, of course, at the heart of this book, is the loss of a parent in a country that is not home. And I felt like I had a sister on the planet. I felt in Chumpa Lahiri's understanding of loss and of exile and of being, just the finality of loss. I felt deeply inspired, really, by that world. And Chumpa, in The Namesake, writes about these two cities of Calcutta and New York, and both cities belong to me and my past. I grew up near Calcutta and in Calcutta for 12 years of my childhood, and then, like the couple in The Namesake, came on to study in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in 1976. And I knew these two worlds very, very well, and felt that I, understood and wanted to inhabit the world of this one, of The Namesake. And when the plane landed in Delhi, I knew Chumpa a little bit. I had met her once. And I called her, like cold, out of the blue, and said, Chumpa, is this novel available? Can I buy the rights? And within 1 week, they were mine. And then I called my dearest friend, Suni Tarapurwala, who is a great writer and filmmaker herself. And I asked Suni, and she had written, of course, Salaam Bombay and Mississippi Masala and my films. And I asked Suni whether she had read it. She said, oh, I've already read it. I love it. And while I was shooting and ending Vanity Fair, I was running back to my hotel room at night and just immersing myself in The Namesake. And within 9 months, it was like giving birth a bit. Within 9 months, I was shooting the movie.
Wow.
It was one of those things, bolts of inspiration.
What a magical story. And what's it like to have a whole city being challenged to not just read the book, but also see your film? The Jacksonville Public Library's Jax Reads Initiative is focusing on your work and Chumpa Lahiri's story as well.
Oh, well, it's an amazing honor. It's a beautiful honor. And I think, you know, now more than ever in our country here, we have to read and know and arm ourselves with knowledge of the rest of the world. Because, you know, the rest of the world is us. And in this time, when there are such schisms being drawn, such walls, literally and metaphorically, being put up between one supposedly one kind of people and another, that is false. You know, that is not, that does not contribute to any understanding of how the world goes. And so I'm especially happy that, you know, Jacksonville will be reading, you know, Jhumpa's remarkable story. And I have to say, seeing my film, which is in one, you know, as a filmmaker, and I've made almost 20 films, when I look back, there are very few films that you can say, oh, this film is exactly pure, is exactly what I wanted it to be. And the namesake, I'm very pleased and humbled, in fact, to say that it is exactly like I want it to be.
That's certainly got to be a good feeling, because, of course, making a film, like you said, it is like birthing a child. And your films really do have so much to say about the gaps between cultures, different races, even different genders, mm-hmm. and how to build bridges between all of us all over the world. So many wonderful films, Salaam Bombay, Monsoon Wedding, most recently Queen of Katwe. But how do you enjoy working in the medium of film to tell these stories? And why do you think film is the most powerful way to express these themes?
Well, you know, Melissa, making films actually is such a privilege, because the elasticity of the art form of cinema allows and encompasses all kinds of art forms. You know, whether you love painting or color or music or performance or how to preserve and how to uncover the emotionality of the human being. I mean, it allows all of that. And yet, one has to, of course, like any other art form or craft form, you have to arm yourself with the knowledge of how to distill, how to create that moment, how to create that world. You know, so I feel, you know, firstly, I feel really grateful that I found cinema when I was 20 years old, when I had the courage and the stamina to take the rejection that comes along with trying to make independent films.
Yeah,
you've got
sure.
to be almost spurred on when you're rejected, because you're full of, it's full of rejections in many ways. It's just also because it's such an expensive art form. You know, you need often thousands, if not millions of dollars to make things like that. So you have to literally convince or con people to come. That is how the word con, by the way, has emerged, is from convince.
Uh-huh. Well, you were very successful at the con, weren't you? I mean, you did a good job.
I'm a good conner. And I basically, you know, and I've always somehow, you know, I've been rooted in India, and which is sort of why I can fly in the world. But I've lived in this country. I came on a scholarship to at Harvard when I was 18, and then I moved to New York when I was 21. And you know, in those days, India was barely people could barely spell the word. I mean, they had no knowledge in this country, especially of India. Mm-hmm. And yet I didn't want to pander. I didn't want to explain constantly my country or my people or my culture. And yet I wanted to make things that inspired me or got under my skin. So that was an interesting, you know, beginning, because it's a seesaw. I was constantly between worlds, and then I began to use that confusion of being between worlds in my work. You know, if you even look at Salaam Bombay, which is about street kids in India, they are the ultimate outsider. They are the ultimate marginal people in our society there. And I feel very much akin to that outsider who is an insider, both. And so that yin and yang, that seesaw between being from the outside looking in and yet being at home within, is kind of very much, I think, become the cornerstone of my work.
Of your work, sure. I'm so excited to even have our listeners hear this short preview of your talk which is coming up in a few weeks. This is so fascinating, and you're such a wonderful artist. We thank you so much for giving us a few minutes of your time on the phone this morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, and looking forward to sunshine in Florida.
That's right. I hope we have a good weekend for you. Acclaimed filmmaker Mira Nair. It will be an afternoon with Mira Nair, director of The Namesake and many other films, part of the Jax Reads Initiative. It's coming up Saturday, March 11th, 1 p.m. at the main downtown library, free and open to all. Visit jaxreads.org for more. And we'll be right back.
As superbugs remain a growing threat, where do we go to find new drugs? How about dirt and the oceans? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we'll talk about prospecting for new antibiotics. Plus, seven new planets orbiting a dwarf star. Might they have conditions for life? And progress toward reversing deafness. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Calling all artists, WJCT is celebrating 45 years on the radio, and we need your help to design the perfect anniversary t-shirt. Design should reflect what WJCT means to you or the First Coast community. The winning design will be featured on a limited edition t-shirt during our spring pledge drive. Get started now at wjct.org/45 years.
On the next Jazz Night in America, vocalist Cecile McLaurin-Sauvant and pianist Sullivan Fortner live in concert at Jazz and Lincoln Center and in conversation in Harlem. The intimacy of two of the most charming new voices in jazz. I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America. I've got
your number. Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's a novel fundraising idea, Women with Heart. Every month this year in Jacksonville, a different local woman is being chosen to wear all around town a fabulous $7,000 heart-shaped diamond necklace. It's all to start a conversation around the nonprofit they support. Now, honorees were chosen based on their contributions to health and wellness in Northeast Florida. At the end of the year, this coveted piece of jewelry will be auctioned off. So, who's wearing it right now? For more on Women with Heart, we welcome Mary Pat Corrigan, CEO of Volunteers in Medicine Jacksonville. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And also joining us, February honoree, Lisa Weatherby of Wells Fargo Advisors, and she's wearing this fabulous necklace. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
All right, so how did this begin? Volunteers in Medicine is the nonprofit you're trying to raise awareness about, Lisa, but you're doing it by wearing this necklace.
Correct.
How did this all get started?
Well, our CEO, Mary Pat Corrigan, and one of our wonderful colleagues there, Cindy Cooper, came up with this fabulous idea. And I think those of us who have been doing charitable events for decades, you just get the idea that there's just nothing new in the world that you can possibly do that's unique and different.
Nothing new under the sun to raise money. But Mary, right. Mary Pat Corrigan, you came up with something new.
I did.
How about that?
I heard the idea from someone else in a different part of the country had done a little bit of it. Uh-huh. And then Cindy really took it to the next level.
How does this work? So Lisa's wearing the necklace all through the month of February.
Correct.
So she's almost having to give it up, unfortunately.
I know. And it's a beautiful necklace that Beards designed for us. And gave us for free, so we appreciate that. And so then next month, Paula Liang will be our Woman with Heart, and she will get the necklace. And each honoree does kind of uniquely does their own events or awareness activities to raise the awareness.
And just by her wearing the necklace around town, sometimes people might ask her about it. And it's an opportunity to talk about Volunteers in Medicine, which, of course, is a free medical clinic for working uninsured people right here in Jacksonville.
Yes, it is. It's a great opportunity. And it's really, it's a very beautiful necklace. And it does also, the honoree is aware of it and uses that as the conversation starter.
What do people say to you about it, Lisa?
Well, it's a great conversation starter. And it, as you can see, it's quite beautiful. And people definitely ask about it if I don't already start the conversation with them about it, which, of course, there is a raffle. There will be a raffle for this beautiful necklace. And
at the end of this year, right?
At the end of... it'll be February because it's, it's not
February
a calendar
next year.
Right. Yeah. So it'll be perfect for somebody's sweetheart for Valentine's Day next year. Have that in the bag. And we'll sell only 150 tickets at $100 a piece. So the odds are really good. And get them before they're gone.
So, Mary Pat, Women with Heart is really just a cool way to raise awareness of what you're doing. By the way, we need to mention the Dolores Barweaver Fund has put out a 100K challenge match for patient outreach. If people donate to Volunteers in Medicine right now, every dollar donated will be doubled.
It will be. Mrs. Weaver's been a wonderful friend to the organization, and this challenge match really is helping us do patient outreach and do outreach to all different cultures in our city really raise the awareness of what our organization does and be able to help more and more people.
And the demand, I'm assuming, is going to continue. There's uncertainty about what our healthcare system is going to look like over the next few years. You're working to reach people with jobs, but they have trouble obtaining health insurance.
That's correct. You know, it's the organization started in 2003, and there have been changes in the healthcare environment, but the one constant is there are always working individuals that do not have health insurance, and we are here to help them.
Well, go to vim-jax.org, vim-jax.org for more about Women with Heart and Volunteers in Medicine, or just ask Lisa Weatherby about it, because chances are you might bump into her, and you're wearing it every day, right?
Oh, yes.
Every day.
Wear it all the time.
Are you sad to give it up soon?
you know, I may try to renegotiate the terms of that with Paula.
Thanks, ladies, for being with us. Mary Pat Corrigan, CEO of Volunteers in Medicine, and the February honoree of Women with Heart, Lisa Weatherby. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
That's our show. 1A's up next with their Friday News Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.